and impossible to keep the stinging salt out of his wounded eye, so puffed and slitted that he couldn't close it tightly. Water ran down his cheek in a steady flow, dripping off his chin. Blinking in a vain attempt to clear his vision, John Gray missed a fallen branch in his path and fell heavily. Those behind him on the narrow trail halted abruptly, with sounds of mild collision, jangling weapons and canteens, confusion and impatience. Rough hands seized him and hauled him up again, but the tall, raw-boned man, deputed to be his escort, said only, "Watch your step, my lord," in a mild tone of voice, and gave him a nudge down the path rather than a shove. Encouraged by this evidence of consideration, he thanked the man and asked his name.
"Me?"
The man sounded surprised.
"Oh, Bumpo. Natty Bumpo."
Adding after a moment,
"Folks mostly call me Hawkeye, though."
"I don't wonder," Gray said half under his breath. He bowed as well as he could whilst walking, and nodded at the long rifle that bobbed in a sling at the man's back.
"Your servant, sir. I deduce that you are a fine shot, then?"
"Reckon that would be a good deduction, your lordship."
Bumpo's voice sounded amused.
"Why, do you want something shot? Or somebody?"
"I'm keeping a list," Gray told him. "I'll let you know when it's complete."
He felt, rather than heard, the other's laugh. The amusement was palpable, but it made little sound.
"Let me guess who's first on your list. The big Scotch fellow, what put your light out?"
"He'd be fairly high on the list, yes." Actually, he couldn't decide who he'd rather see shot first. Jamie Fraser, or his own bloody brother. Probably Hal, all things considered. Rather ironic if Hal ended up getting him shot. Though his captors seemed quite convinced that hanging was the preferred method. That reminded him of the uncomfortable bit of conversation that had preceded his being chivvied through the woods on a deer trail bountifully equipped with bramblish bushes, low-hanging branches, ticks and biting flies the size of the ball of his thumb.
"Would you happen to know what, or possibly who, Paoli is, Mr. Bumpo?"
he asked politely, kicking a fir cone out of his way.
"What's Paoli?"
The man's voice was filled with astonishment.
"Why, man, are you just come to this neck of the woods?"
"Fairly recently," Gray replied guardedly.
"Oh."
Bumpo considered, carefully matching his lengthy stride to Gray's shorter one.
"Why, 'twas an infamous attack, to be sure. Your kinsman, Major General Gray, as they said, him and his troops snuck up by night to where General Wayne's men were camped. Gray didn't want to risk a stray flint sparking and giving them away. So he gives the order to take out all the flints from their guns and use the bayonets. Fell upon the Americans and bayoneted near 100 men in their beds, in cold blood." "Really?"
Gray tried to reconcile this account with any recent battle he knew of and failed.
"And Paoli?" "Oh, that's the name of the tavern nearby. Paoli's Tavern."
"Ah. Where is it, geographically, I mean? And when exactly did this battle occur?" Bumpo's prehensile lips pushed out in thought, then withdrew.
"Be up near Malvern last September. The Paoli Massacre, they calls it," he added with a certain dubiousness.
"Massacre?" Gray echoed. The engagement had taken place before his own arrival, but he'd heard it talked about, briefly, and not in terms of massacre, to be sure. But then perceptions of the event were bound to be different, depending upon one's position in the matter. William Howe had spoken of it with approval, as a successful engagement in which a minimal number of British troops had routed an entire American division, with a loss of only 7 men. Bumpo seemed disposed to share Gray's opinion of the rhetorical nature of the name, albeit from yet a third perspective.
"Well, you know how folks will talk," he said, lifting one shoulder. "Ain't what I'd call a proper massacre, but then ain't many folks seen one, and I have."
"You have?" Glancing up at the tall, bearded ruffian, Gray thought it only too likely.
was raised as an Indian, Bumpo said with a visible pride. By the Mohican, my own folks having died when I was just a tadpole.
I've seen a massacre or two.
Indeed, Gray said, innate courtesy obliging him to invite the man to elaborate, should he wish to. Besides, it would pass the time. They seemed to have been walking for hours, and no end in sight. Not that he was eagerly anticipating the end. As it was, Mr. Bumpo's reminiscences passed the time to such good effect that Gray was surprised when Corporal Woodbine, in the lead, called the company to a halt at the edge of a fairly sizable encampment. He was glad enough to stop, though. He was wearing city shoes, not suited for the terrain at all, and they had worn through his stockings and rubbed his feet to blood and blisters.
"Scout Bumpo," Woodbine said, with a short nod to Gray's companion, "you'll take the company on to Zeke Bowen's place. I'll deliver the prisoner to Colonel Smith."
This statement gave rise to vocal discontent, from which Gray gathered that the company wished very much to accompany Woodbine in order not to miss Gray's execution, which they confidently expected to occur within moments of his delivery to the aforesaid Colonel Smith. Woodbine was firm about it, though, and with democratic mutterings and execrations, the militia moved reluctantly off under the guidance of Natty Bumpo. Woodbine watched them out of sight, then drew himself up, brushing a stray caterpillar from the breast of his shabby coat and straightening his disreputable hat.
"Well, Lieutenant Colonel Gray, shall we go?"
Natty Bumpo's reminiscences of the proper way to conduct a massacre had left Gray with the feeling that perhaps, by contrast, hanging was not the worst way to die. But while he hadn't personally witnessed any first-rate massacres, he'd seen men hanged, very close to, and the memory of it dried his throat. The leakage from his eye hadn't stopped completely, but had lessened. The skin felt raw and inflamed, though, and the swelling gave him the annoying sense that his head was grossly misshapen. Still, he drew himself upright and strode chin out into the ragged canvas tent ahead of Corporal Woodbine. Colonel Smith looked up from his lap desk, startled at the intrusion, though not quite as startled as Gray. He'd last seen Watson Smith in his own sister-in-law's drawing-room in London 2 years ago, eating cucumber sandwiches, in the uniform of a captain of the Buffs. "Mr. Smith," he said, recovering his wits first. He bowed very correctly.
"Your servant, sir."
He didn't bother trying to keep the edge out of his voice or his expression. He sat down upon a vacant stool without being invited, and gave Smith as direct a stare as he could with one operant eye. Smith's cheeks flushed, but he leaned back a little, gathering his own wits before replying, and returned Gray's stare with interest. He was not a big man, but had broad shoulders and considerable presence of manner, and Gray knew him to be a very competent soldier. Competent enough not to reply directly to Gray, but to turn instead to Corporal Woodbine.
"Corporal, how comes this gentleman here?"
"This is Lieutenant Colonel Lord John Gray, sir," Woodbine said. He was nearly bursting with pride at his capture, and placed Gray's King's warrant and Gray's accompanying note on the rickety table with the manner of a butler presenting a roast pheasant with diamond eyes to a reigning monarch. "We caught him in the woods near Philadelphia, out of uniform, there, as you see, sir."
He cleared his throat in emphasis.
"And he admits to being a cousin of Major General Charles Gray. You know, the Paoli massacre."
"Really?"
Smith picked up the papers, but cocked an eyebrow at Gray.
"What was he doing there?"
"Having the shit beaten out of him by Colonel Fraser, sir. He's one of Morgan's officers, he said," Woodbine added, with less certainty.
Smith looked blank.
"Fraser? Don't believe I know him."
Switching his attention to Gray, he addressed him for the first time.
"Do you know Colonel Fraser? Colonel Gray?"
The elaborate hesitation spoke volumes. Well, he hadn't expected anything else. Gray wiped his nose as well as he could on a forearm and sat straight.
I decline to answer your questions, sir. They are improperly put. You know my name, rank, and regiment. Beyond that, my business is my own.
Smith stared at him, eyes narrowed. Smith's eyes were rather attractive, a pale grey with black brows and lashes,
very dramatic. Gray had noticed them when the man came to tea with Minnie.
Woodbine coughed.
Colonel Fraser said the man was his prisoner, sir. But he wouldn't say what for, and when I pressed the matter, he, left. That's when we searched the Lord Colonel here and found his papers.
He left, Smith repeated carefully.
And you allowed him to leave, Corporal?
Woodbine was looking less confident in the virtue of his conduct, but wasn't the sort to be easily cowed, Gray saw. He lowered his brows and gave Smith a look of his own.
Couldn't have stopped him, short of shooting him, sir, he added flatly.
The flesh around Smith's nostrils whitened, and Gray had the distinct impression that the Englishman must find his new command not quite what he'd been used to. The quarters certainly weren't. While Smith's continental uniform was smart and well-tended, and his wig in good order, his tent, while large, appeared to have been through several campaigns, being worn to threads in places and patched in others. Not entirely a bad thing, Gray thought, briefly closing his eyes as a faint evening breeze came wafting through the walls of the tent, relieving the stifling heat. He had a noticeable headache, and even such minor relief was welcome.
"Very well, Corporal,"
Smith said, after a moment, having evidently tried and failed to think of something new to ask.
"Well done,"
he added, offering a belated note of congratulation.
"Thank you, sir."
Woodbine hovered, obviously loath to surrender his share of the excitement.
"If I may ask, sir, what do you mean to do with the prisoner?"
Gray opened his eye and a half, interested to hear what the answer might be, and found Smith eyeing him in what seemed a faintly carnivorous fashion. The turncoat smiled.
"Oh, I'll think of something, Corporal Woodbine," he said.
"You are dismissed. Good night."
Smith got up and came over to Gray, leaning down to examine his face. Gray could smell his sweat, sharp and musky.
"Do you need a doctor?"
he asked dispassionately, but without hostility.
"No,"
Gray said. Both his head and his side ached deeply, and he felt dizzy. But he doubted there was anything a doctor could do about either condition. And he found that after prolonged contact with Claire and her opinions, he had much less trust in physicians than heretofore, and he hadn't had much to begin with. Smith nodded, and, straightening up, went to a battered campaign chest and dug out two dented pewter cups and a stone bottle of what proved to be applejack. He poured two generous tots, and they sat in silence for a time, sipping. So close to midsummer day, it was still bright light out, though Gray could hear the rattle and shuffle of a camp beginning the evening routine. A mule brayed loudly, and several more answered it in raucous chorus. Wagons, then? Perhaps artillery? He breathed deeply, nostrils flaring. An artillery company had a distinct smell to it, a sort of distillation of sweat, black powder, and hot metal, much more pungent than the scent of an infantry company with their muskets. The scent of searing iron seeped into an artillery man's clothes, as well as his soul. What came to him was not the stink of guns, but the smell of roasting meat. It drifted through the tent, and his stomach growled loudly. He'd eaten nothing since the beer that had been his preliminary to a preempted meal. He thought Smith's mouth twitched a little at the noise, but the colonel politely ignored it. Smith finished his drink, refilled both cups, and cleared his throat.
"I will not plague you with questions, as you don't wish to answer them," he said carefully. "But in the interests of civil conversation, should you wish to make any inquiries of me, I should not take offence."
Gray smiled wryly.
Very gracious of you, sir. Do you wish to justify your present allegiance to me? I assure you, it's unnecessary.
Small red patches sprang up immediately on Smith's cheekbones.
That was not my intent, sir, he said stiffly.
Then I apologize,
Gray said, and took another mouthful. The sweet, strong cider was assuaging his hunger pangs as well as the pain in his side, though it admittedly wasn't doing much for the dizziness.
What sort of question did you think I might ask? What is the current state of the Continental Army? I could deduce that easily enough, I think, from the state of the gentleman who captured me, and other evidence.
He let his eyes roam deliberately around the tent, taking in the chipped pottery utensil under the lopsided cot, the tail of dirty linen straggling out of a portmanteau in the corner. Evidently, Smith had either no orderly or an inept one. For an instant, Gray felt a pang of nostalgia for Tom Bird, the best valet he had ever had. Smith's flush had faded. He gave a small ironic laugh.
I imagine you could. It's not much of a secret.
No, I rather thought you might be curious as to what I propose to do with you.
Oh, that.
Gray put down his cup and rubbed gingerly at his forehead, trying not to touch the swollen area around his eye.
Frankly, I'd forgotten in the surprise of seeing you. And the pleasure of your kind hospitality, he added, lifting the cup with no irony at all. Corporal Woodbine and his men appear to think I should be promptly hanged, both on the charge of spying and on the more serious one of being related to Major General Charles Gray, who, I gather, is believed to have committed some atrocity at a place called Paoli.
Smith's brow creased.
Do you deny being a spy? Don't be ridiculous, Smith. I'm a lieutenant colonel. What on earth would I be doing spying in a deserted wood? Well, deserted until Woodbine and his merry men showed up, he added.
His cup was empty. He stared into it, wondering how that had happened. With a small sigh, Smith refilled it.
Besides, I was carrying no documents of information, no secret writings, no evidence whatever of spying.
Doubtless you committed to memory whatever information you'd gained, Smith said, sounding cynically amused. I recall that you have a prodigious memory.
He gave a small snort that could perhaps have been called a snigger.
So saith Sally, nimble-fingered as her grip upon his prick did linger.
In fact, Gray's memory was quite good. Good enough to remember a dinner at which a number of officers from different regiments had been guests. When the gentlemen were at their port, Gray had, upon invitation, and to thunderous applause, recited entirely from memory one of the longer and very scabrous odes from Harry Quarry's infamous Certain Verses upon the Subject of Eros, copies of which were still eagerly sought and covertly passed around the circles of society, though the book had been published nearly 20 years before.
"What on earth is there to spy on?" he demanded,
realizing the logical trap too late.
Smith's mouth turned up at one corner.
"You expect me to tell you?"
Because the answer, of course, was that Washington's entire force was likely on the move in his immediate vicinity, positioning for the move into Philadelphia, and very possibly for an attack on Clinton's withdrawing troops. Gray dismissed Smith's question as rhetorical and took another tack, though a dangerous one.
"Woodbine gave you a correct assessment of the circumstances in which he discovered me," he said. "Plainly, I was not discovered in flagrante by Colonel Fraser, as he would simply have done what Corporal Woodbine did, and arrested me."
"Are you asserting that Colonel Fraser met you by arrangement to pass on information?"
Jesus Christ. He'd known this tack was dangerous, but he hadn't foreseen that possibility, that Jamie Fraser would be suspected of being his confederate.
But of course, Smith would be particularly sensitive to such a possibility, given his own change of loyalties.
"Certainly not," Gray said, allowing a certain asperity to creep into his tone.
The encounter that Corporal Woodbine witnessed was of a purely personal nature.
Smith, who plainly knew a thing or two about interrogation, cocked a brow at him. Gray knew a thing or two about it too, and sat back, sipping his applejack insouciantly, as though quite sure his statement had settled matters.
"They will probably hang you, you know," Smith said, after a suitable pause.
He spoke quite casually, eyes on the amber stream as he refilled both cups again.
"After what Howe did to Captain Hale. Even more after Paoli. Charles Gray is your cousin, is he not?"
"Second or third cousin, yes."
Gray knew the man, though they didn't move in the same circles, either socially or militarily. Charles Gray was a pig-faced professional killer rather than a soldier, and while he doubted that the Paoli massacre had been entirely as described, what sort of idiots would lie on the ground waiting to be bayoneted in their beds? Because he didn't for an instant think a column of infantry was capable of sneaking up in the dark over rough country to within stabbing distance without giving some notice of their presence. He did know about Charles's merciless bayonet tactics at Culloden.
"Nonsense," Gray said, with as much confidence as he could summon. "Whatever one may think of the American High Command, I doubt it is composed entirely of fools. My execution would yield nothing, whereas my exchange might be of value. My brother does have some small influence."
Smith smiled, not without sympathy.
"An excellent argument, Lord John, and one I'm sure would find favour with General Washington. Unfortunately, the Congress and the King remain at loggerheads over the matter of exchange. At present, there is no mechanism to allow the exchange of prisoners."
That one struck him in the pit of the stomach. He knew all too well that there were no official channels of exchange. He'd been trying to have William exchanged for months. Smith upended the bottle, dribbling the last amber drops into Gray's cup.
"Are you a Bible-reading man, Colonel Gray?"
Gray looked at him blankly.
"Not habitually. I have read it, though. Some of it. Well, bits."
"Why?"
"I wondered if you were familiar with the concept of a scapegoat."
Smith rocked back a little on his stool, gazing at Gray with his lovely, deep-set eyes, which seemed to hold a certain sympathy. Though perhaps it was just the applejack.
"Because I'm afraid that is where your chief value lies, Colonel. It is no secret that the Continental Army is in poor condition, lacking money, disillusion and desertion rife. Nothing would hearten and unify the troops more, or send a more potent message to General Clinton, than the trial and very public execution of a high-ranking British officer, a convicted spy, and close relation to the infamous No Flints Gray."
He belched softly and blinked, eyes still fixed on Gray.
"You asked what I meant to do with you."
"No, I didn't."
Smith ignored this, levelling a long, knobby finger at him.
"I'm sending you to General Wayne, who, believe me, has Paoli carved upon his heart."
"How very painful for him," Gray said politely, and drained his cup. Chapter 12. Eine kleine Nachtmusik. The interminable day was reluctantly ending, the heat at last beginning to fade from the forest, along with the waning light. He didn't suppose that he would be taken directly to General Wayne, unless that worthy were close at hand, and he thought not. He could tell from the sounds and the feel of the camp that it was a small one, and plainly Colonel Smith was the senior officer present. Smith had asked him, pro forma, to give his parole, and had been substantially taken aback when Gray had courteously refused to do so.
"If I am, in fact, a duly commissioned British officer," Gray had pointed out, "then clearly it is my duty to escape."
Smith eyed him. the failing light shading his face with sufficient ambiguity that Grey wasn't sure whether he was fighting an impulse to smile or not.
Probably not.
"You're not escaping," he said definitely,
and went out. Grey could hear a brief, heated discussion, conducted in low voices outside the tent, as to just what to do with him. A militia camp on the move had no facilities for prisoners. Grey amused himself by composing a mental entertainment in which Smith was obliged to share his narrow cot with Grey in the interests of keeping his prisoner secure. In the end, though, a corporal came in, carrying a rusty set of fetters that looked as though they had last seen use during the Spanish Inquisition, and took Grey to the edge of camp, where a soldier, who had been a blacksmith in private life, banged them into place with a stout hammer, using a flattish rock as an anvil. He felt the oddest sensations, kneeling on the ground in the twilight, an interested group of militiamen gathered round in a circle to watch. He was forced to lean forward in a crouching posture, hands laid before him, as though he were about to be beheaded, and the hammer blows echoed through the metal into the bones of his wrists and arms. He kept his eyes on the hammer, and not only from fear that the smith would miss his aim in the growing dusk and smash one of his hands. Under the influence of intoxication, and a growing, deeper fear that he didn't want to acknowledge, he sensed the mingled curiosity and animus surrounding him, and felt it as he would a nearby thunderstorm, electricity crawling over his skin, the threat of lightning annihilation so close he could smell its sharp odour mixed with gunpowder, and the heavy tang of the sweat of men. Ozone. His mind seized on the word, a small escape into rationality. That's what Claire called the smell of lightning. He told her he thought it was from the Greek, ozone, the neuter present participle of ozane, meaning to smell. He began to work his way methodically through the complete conjugation. By the time he'd finished, surely they would be done with it. Ozane, to smell. I smell? He could smell his own sweat, sharp and sweet. In the old days it was considered a better death, beheading. To be hanged was shameful, a commoner's death, a criminal's death. Slower. He knew that for a fact. A final reverberating blow and a visceral sound of satisfaction from the watching men. He was made prisoner. There being no shelter other than the brushy wigwams and scraps of canvas the militiamen rigged near their fires, he was escorted back to Smith's big threadbare tent, given supper, which he forced down, not much noticing what he ate, and then tethered to the tent pole with a long, thin rope run through the chain of his irons, with sufficient play as to allow him to lie down or use the utensil. At Smith's insistence, he took the cot, and did lie down with a slight groan of relief. His temples throbbed with each heartbeat, and so did the entire left side of his face, which was now radiating small jolts down into his upper teeth, very unpleasant. The pain in his side had dulled to a deep ache, almost negligible by comparison. Luckily, he was so tired that sleep swamped all discomfort, and he fell into it with a sense of profound gratitude. He woke in the full dark some time later, slicked with sweat, heart hammering from some desperate dream. He raised a hand to push the soaked hair of his face and felt the heavy, chafing weight of the fetters which he'd forgotten about. They clanked, and the dark figure of a sentry silhouetted in the fire glow at the entrance of the tent turned sharply toward him, but then relaxed as he turned over in the cot, clanking further.
Bugger, he thought, still groggy with sleep. Couldn't even masturbate if I wanted to.
The thought made him laugh, though fortunately it came out as a mere breath of sound.
Another body turned over, rustling, shifting heavily near him.
Smith, he supposed, sleeping on a canvas bedsack stuffed with grass. Grey could smell the meadow scent of dry hay, faintly musty in the humid air. The bedsack was standard issue to the British Army, Smith must have kept it, along with his tent and other equipment, changing only his uniform.
Why had he turned his coat? Gray wondered, vaguely, peering at Smith's humped shape just visible against the pale canvas.
Advancement?
Starved as they were for professional soldiers, the Continentals offered rank as inducement. A captain in any European army might become anything from a major to a general in the blink of an eye, whereas the only means of achieving higher rank in England was to find the money to purchase it.
What was rank without pay, though?
Gray was no longer a spy, but he had been one, once, and still knew men who labored in those dark fields. From what he'd heard, the American Congress had no money at all, and depended upon loans, these unpredictable in amount and erratic in occurrence. Some from French or Spanish sources, though the French wouldn't admit to it, of course. Some from Jewish moneylenders, said one of his correspondents. Salomon, Solomon, some name like that. These random musings were interrupted by a sound that made him stiffen. A woman's laughter. There were women in the camp, wives who had come along to war with their husbands. He'd seen a few when they took him across the campground, and one had brought his supper, glancing suspiciously up at him from under her cap. But he thought he knew that laugh, deep, gurgling, and totally unself-conscious. Jesus, he whispered under his breath. Dotty?
It wasn't impossible. He swallowed, trying to clear his left ear to listen to the multitude of small sounds outside.
Denzel Hunter was a Continental surgeon, and Dotty had, to her brother's, cousin's, and uncle's horror, joined the camp followers at Valley Forge in order to help her fiancé, though she rode into Philadelphia regularly to visit her brother Henry. If Washington's forces were moving, and very plainly they were, it was entirely possible that a surgeon might be anywhere among them. A high, clear voice raised in question. An English voice, and not common. He strained to hear, but couldn't make out the words. He wished she'd laugh again. If it was Dotty. He breathed deep, trying to think. He couldn't call out to her. He'd felt the avid hostility directed at him from every man in camp. Letting the relationship be known would be dangerous for her and Denzel both, and certainly wouldn't help Gray. And yet he had to risk it. They'd move him in the morning. Out of sheer inability to think of anything better, he sat up on the cot and began to sing Die Sommernacht. Quietly at first, but gathering strength and volume. As he hit In den Kühlungen Wein, at the top of his very resonant tenor voice, Smith sat up like a jack-in-the-box and said, What? In tones of utter amazement. Gray went on, reducing his volume somewhat. He didn't want Dotty, if it was Dotty, coming to look, only to let her know he was here. He'd taught her this lead when she was 14. She sang it often at musicales. He stopped, coughed a little, and spoke into the marked silence before him, slurring his words a bit, as though still drunk. In fact, he discovered he was.
Might I have some water, Colonel? Will you sing any more if I give it to you?
Smith asked, deeply suspicious.
No. I think I'm finished now,
Gray assured him.
Couldn't sleep, you know. Too much to drink. But I find a song settles the mind remarkably. Oh, does it?
Smith breathed heavily for a moment, but clambered to his feet and fetched the ewer from his basin. Gray could feel him repressing an urge to douse his prisoner with the contents, but Smith was a man of strong character and merely held the pitcher for him to drink, then put it back and resumed his own bed with no more than a few irritable snorts. The lead had caused some comment in the camp, and a few musical souls took it as inspiration and began singing everything from Greensleeves, a very poignant and tender rendition, to Chester. Gray quite enjoyed the singing, though it was only by exercise of his own strong character that he refrained from shaking his fetters at the end of "Let tyrants shake their iron rods, and slavery clank her galling chains." They were still singing when he fell asleep again, to dream in anxious fragments, the fumes of Applejack drifting through the hollow spaces of his head. Number 17, Chestnut Street. The bell of the Presbyterian church struck midnight, but the city wasn't sleeping. The sounds were more furtive now, muffled by darkness, but the streets were still alive with hurrying feet and the sound of moving wagons. And in the far distance, I heard a faint cry of "Fire!" being raised. I stood by the open window, sniffing the air for smoke and watching out for any sign of flames that might spread in our direction. I wasn't aware of Philadelphia having ever burned to the ground like London or Chicago, but a fire that merely engulfed the neighborhood would be just as bad from my point of view. There was no wind at all, that was something. The summer air hung heavy, damp as a sponge. I waited for a bit, but the cries stopped, and I saw no red glimmer of flames against the half-clouded sky. No trace of fire, save the cool green sparks of fireflies drifting among the shadowed leaves in the front garden. I stood for a bit, letting my shoulders slump, letting go of my half-formed plans for emergency evacuation. I was exhausted, but unable to sleep. Beyond the need to keep an eye on my unsettled patient and the unsettled atmosphere beyond the quiet room, I was most unsettled in myself. I'd been listening all day, constantly on the alert for a familiar footstep, the sound of Jamie's voice. But he hadn't come. What if he had learned from John that I'd shared his bed on that one drunken evening? Would the shock of that, given without preparation or suitable explanation, be enough to have made him run away? For good? I felt sudden tears come to my eyes and shut them hard to stem the flow, gripping the sill with both hands. Don't be ridiculous. He'll come as soon as he can, no matter what. You know he will. I did know. But the shocked joy of seeing him alive had wakened nerves that had been numb for a long time. And while I might seem calm externally, on the inside my emotions were at a roiling boil. The steam was building up, and I had no way to release the pressure, save pointless tears, and I wouldn't give way to those. For one thing, I might not be able to stop. I pressed the sleeve of my dressing gown briefly to my eyes, then turned back resolutely into the darkness of the room. A small brazier burned near the bed under a tented wet cloth, casting a flickering red glow on Pardlow's sharp-cut features. He was breathing with an audible rasp, and I could hear his lungs rattle with each exhalation, but it was a deep breathing and regular. It occurred to me that I might not have been able to smell the smoke of a fire outside, had there been one. The atmosphere in the room was thick with oil of peppermint, eucalyptus, and cannabis. Despite the wet cloth, enough smoke had escaped the brazier to form a hanging cloud of purling wisps, moving pale as ghosts in the darkened air. I sprinkled more water on the muslin tent and sat down in the small armchair beside the bed, breathing the saturated atmosphere in cautiously, but with an agreeable small sense of illicit pleasure. Hal had told me he was in the habit of smoking hemp to relax his lungs, and that it seemed to be effective. He'd said hemp, and that was undoubtedly what he'd been smoking. The psychoactive form of the plant didn't grow in England and wasn't commonly imported. I hadn't any hemp leaves in my medical supply, but did have a good bit of ganja, which John had acquired from a Philadelphia merchant who had two Indiamen. It was useful in the treatment of glaucoma, as I'd learned when treating Jamie's aunt Jocasta. It relieved nausea and anxiety, and it had occasional non-medicinal uses, as John had informed me, to my private amusement. Thought of John gave me a small internal qualm to add to my anxiety over Jamie, and I took a deep, deliberate breath of the sweet, spicy air. Where was he?
What had Jamie done with him?
Do you ever make bargains with God?
Hal's voice came quietly out of the half-dark. I must subconsciously have known he wasn't sleeping, for I wasn't startled. Everyone does, I said. Even people who don't believe in God. Do you? There was the breath of a laugh, followed by coughing, but it stopped quickly. Perhaps the smoke was helping.
Have you got such a bargain in mind? I asked, as much from real curiosity as to make conversation.
You aren't going to die, you know. I won't let you.
Yes, you said that, he replied dryly.
After a moment's hesitation, he turned on his side to face me.
I do believe you, he said rather formally, and I thank you.
You're quite welcome. I can't let you die in John's house, you know. He'd be upset. He smiled at that, his face visible in the brazier's glow. We didn't speak for a bit, but sat looking at each other, with no particular sense of self-consciousness. Both of us calmed by the smoke and the sleepy chirping of crickets outside. The sound of wagon wheels had ceased, but there were still people passing by. Surely I would know Jamie's step, be able to distinguish his, even among so many.
You're worried about him, aren't you? He asked. John.
No, I said quickly. But I saw one dark brow rise and remembered that he already knew me for a bad liar. That is, I'm sure he's quite all right, but I would have expected him home by now, with so much commotion in the city. I waved a hand toward the window. You don't know what might happen, do you? I heard him draw breath, his chest rattling faintly, and clear his throat.
And you still decline to tell me where he is?
I lifted one shoulder and let it fall. It seemed pointless to repeat that I didn't know, even though that was the truth. Instead, I took up a comb from the table and began to deal slowly with my hair, untangling and smoothing the unruly mass, enjoying the cool feel of it in my hands. After we had bathed Hal and got him put to bed, I'd taken a quarter hour for a somewhat more leisurely wash of my own and had rinsed the sweat and dust from my hair, despite knowing that it would take hours to dry in the humid air.
The bargain I had in mind was not for my own life, he said after a bit, as such.
I'm sure John isn't going to die either, if that's what you...
Not John. My son, my daughter, and my grandson. You have grandchildren, I collect. I believe I heard that rather stalwart young man call you Granny this afternoon, did I not?
His voice held a trace of amusement. You did, and I do. You mean Dorothea? Is something the matter with her? A stab of alarm made me set down the comb. I'd seen Dottie only a few days before, at the house where her brother Henry was staying.
Aside from the fact that she appears to be on the verge of marrying a rebel, and declares her intent to accompany the man on to battlefields and to live with him under the most insalubrious conditions imaginable.
He sat up in bed and spoke with evident passion, but I couldn't help smiling at his mode of expression. Evidently the Grey brothers shared the same habit of speech. I coughed to hide this, though, and replied as tactfully as possible. You've seen Dottie, then?
Yes, I have, he said shortly. She was with Henry when I arrived yesterday, and wearing the most extraordinary garment. Evidently the man to whom she considers herself affianced is a Quaker, and she declares that she has become one as well.
So I understand, I murmured. You hadn't heard about it?
No, I had not. And I have a few things to say to John regarding both his cowardice in not telling me about it and his son's unpardonable machinations.
The collar in this speech literally choked him, and he had to stop and cough, wrapping his arms round his knees to steady himself against the racking spasms. I took up the fan I'd left on the table earlier and wafted a bit of smoke from the brazier into his face. He gasped, coughed harder for a moment,
and then subsided, wheezing. "I'd tell you not to excite yourself if I thought there was the slightest chance of you listening," I remarked, handing him a cup of the boiled tincture of ephedra in coffee. "Drink that. Slowly." "As for John," I went on, watching him make faces over the bitter taste, "he considered writing to you when he found out what Dotty intended. He didn't, because at the time he thought it might be nothing more than a passing whim, and that once she'd seen the reality of Denny, that's her fiancé, Dr. Hunter, of his life, she might think better of it. And if she did, there was no need to alarm you and your wife. He never expected you to turn up here." Hal coughed once, then drew breath in a tentative fashion.
"I didn't either," he said,
and putting the cup aside, coughed again and lay back against the heaped pillows.
"The War Office decided to send my regiment to support Clinton when the new strategy was decided upon. There wasn't time to write."
"Which new strategy is this?" I asked, only mildly interested.
"To sever the southern colonies from the north, suppress the rebellion there, and thus starve the north into submission. Keep the bloody French out of the West Indies, too," he added as an afterthought. "You think Dotty might change her mind?"
He sounded dubious but hopeful. "Actually, no," I said. I stretched and ran my fingers through my damp hair, which had settled softly on my neck and shoulders, curling light and tickling round my face. "I wondered whether it was you or your wife she took after in terms of willfulness, but the instant I met you, it was clear." He gave me a narrow look, but had the grace to smile.
"She does," he admitted. "So does Benjamin, my eldest son. Henry and Adam are both like my wife in terms of temperament. Which doesn't mean that they aren't capable of seeking their own way," he added thoughtfully. "Only that they're rather more diplomatic about it."
"I'd like to meet your wife," I said, smiling too. "Her name is Minnie," John said.
"Minerva," he said,
his smile growing more genuine.
"Minerva Cunegonda, to be exact. Couldn't call her Cunny, could I?"
"Probably not in public, no."
"Wouldn't try it in private either,"
he assured me.
"She's very demure to look at."
I laughed and darted a glance at the brazier. I hadn't thought the active principle in ganja would be very strong, burned as an atmospheric rather than smoked directly. Still, it was obviously having a beneficial effect on Hal's mood as well as his asthma, and I was conscious of a slight feeling of well-being beginning to creep into my own outlook. I was still worried about Jamie. And John. But the worry had lifted from my shoulders and seemed to be floating a little way above my head, still visible, and a dull purple-grey in colour, but floating. "Like a lead balloon," I thought, and gave a small amused snort. Hal was lying back, eyes half-lidded, watching me with a sort of detached interest.
"You're a beautiful woman," he said,
sounding faintly surprised.
"Not demure, though,"
he added, and made a low, chuckling noise.
"What could John have been thinking?"
I knew what John had been thinking, but didn't want to talk about it, for assorted reasons. "What did you mean earlier," I asked curiously, "about making bargains with God?"
"Ah."
His eyelids closed slowly.
"When I arrived at General Clinton's office this morning..." God, was that only this morning? "He had rather bad news for me. And a letter. Sent some weeks ago from New Jersey, forwarded eventually to him through the army post. My eldest son, Benjamin, was captured by the rebels at the Brandywine," he said,
almost dispassionately. Almost. There was enough light for me to see the bulge of his jaw muscle.
"There is at present no agreement with the Americans involving the exchange of prisoners, so he remains in captivity."
"Where?" I asked, disturbed at the news.
"I don't know that," he said shortly. "Yet. but I shall discover his whereabouts as quickly as possible.
Godspeed, I said sincerely. Was the letter from Benjamin?
No.
His jaw tightened a little further. The letter had been from a young woman named Aramanthus Cowden, who informed His Grace, the Duke of Padlow, that she was the wife of his son Benjamin, and the mother of Benjamin's son, Trevor Wattiswade Grey, aged 3 months. Born after Benjamin was captured, I thought, and wondered whether Benjamin knew about the baby. The young Mrs. Grey found herself in difficult circumstances, she wrote, owing to her husband's sad absence, and therefore proposed to go to her relatives in Charleston. She felt some delicacy in approaching His Grace for assistance, but her state was such that she felt she had little choice in the matter, and hoped that he would forgive her forwardness and look kindly upon her plea. She enclosed a lock of her son's hair, feeling that His Grace might like to have such a keepsake of his grandson. "Dear me," I said. I hesitated for a moment, but the same thought must surely have occurred to him. "Do you think she's telling the truth?" He sighed, a mixture of anxiety and aggravation.
"Almost certainly she is. My wife's maiden name was Wattiswade, but no one outside the family would know that."
He nodded toward the wardrobe where Mrs. Fig had hung his uniform.
"The letter is in my coat, should you wish to read it."
I waved a hand in polite dismissal. "I see what you meant about making bargains with God. You want to live to see your grandchild, and your son, of course." He sighed again, his lean body seeming to diminish slightly. Mrs. Fig had undone his queue, much against his will, brushed out his hair, and tied it in a loose tail that now fell over his shoulder, a soft dark brown shot with streaks of white that glinted red and gold in the fire glow.
"Not precisely. I do want that, of course, but..."
He groped for words, quite unlike his earlier elegant loquacity.
"You die for them happily, your family. But at the same time you think, Christ, I can't die. What might happen to them if I weren't here?"
He gave me a wry and rueful smile.
"And you know bloody well that you mostly can't help them anyway. They've got to do it, or not, themselves."
"Unfortunately, yes." A draught of air moved the muslin curtains and stirred the hanging pall of smoke. "Not the grandchildren, though. You can help them." And I suddenly missed Henri Christian's soft weight, his solid head against my shoulder. I'd saved his life by removing his tonsils and adenoids, and I thanked God that I'd been in time to do it. And Mandy.
"God take care of her,"
I prayed fiercely. I'd been able to tell Bree what was wrong and that it could be fixed. But I couldn't fix her heart defect, and I regretted that lack every day of my life. If I could have done the necessary surgery in this time, they'd all still be here. The curtains moved again, and the heavy atmosphere drew a clean, sudden breath. I inhaled deeply, catching the faint, sharp scent of ozone. "Rain," I said. "Rain's coming." The Duke didn't reply, but turned, lifting his face toward the window. I got up and raised the sash higher, letting in a grateful, cool breeze. I looked out into the night again. Clouds were drifting fast across the moon, so the light seemed to pulse rather than flicker, like the beat of a palpitating heart. The streets were dark, with no more than the occasional glow of a moving lantern to mark the muted agitation of the city. Rain might damp the movement of both fleeing loyalists and the army readying itself to depart. Would the cover of the storm make it easier for Jamie to come into the city? A bad storm might hamper him, turning the roads to mud. How far away was he? The lead balloon had come down on my head. My mood had taken a plunge, whether from fatigue, the oncoming storm, or merely as a natural effect of cannabinol. I didn't know. I shivered, though the air was still hot,
unable to keep my brain from projecting vivid images of all the dire possibilities that could befall a man caught between two armies, alone in the night. Maybe alone? What had he done with John? Surely he wouldn't have...
I was 21 when my father died,
Hal remarked out of the blue.
Grown. Had my own life. Had a wife.
He broke off abruptly, his mouth twisting.
Didn't think I needed him at all, until he suddenly wasn't there.
What could he have done for you? I asked, sitting down again. I was curious, but also anxious to avoid my own racing thoughts. Hal lifted one slender shoulder. The neck of the nightshirt was unbuttoned, because of both the heat, and so I could more easily see the pulse in his neck. It fell open, the cloth limp with moisture, and his clavicle showed, high-arched and clean, shadowed sharp against his skin.
"Been there,"
he said simply.
"Listened. Perhaps approved of what I was doing."
The last few words came low, barely audible.
Or maybe not.
But
been there.
I know what you mean, I said, more to myself than to him. I'd been lucky. I was very young when my parents died, and my uncle had stepped promptly into my life to be there for me. And casual as his own life had been, he always was there. I'd felt his loss acutely when he died, but I'd been married then. A spasm of guilt seized me out of nowhere, thinking of Frank. And another, worse, thinking of Brianna. I'd left her once. And then she had left me. That unleashed a jumble of morbid thoughts, of Lyra, abandoned by both daughters, unlikely ever to see her grandchildren, now mine, of Jem and Mandy. And Jamie. Where was he? And why wasn't he here? Surely, whatever John might have told him. Oh, dear, I said, hopelessly under my breath. I could feel the tears prick and well, pressing up against the dam of my determination.
Do you know, I'm most remarkably hungry, Hal said, sounding surprised. Is there any food in the house?
Jamie's stomach growled, and he coughed to cover the sound, but there was no need. The little girls were curled up like a pair of capped hedgehogs under a tattered quilt by the hearth, back to back, and snoring like drunken bumblebees. Mrs. Hardman was on the settle, singing to the baby under her breath. He couldn't make out the words, so couldn't tell what song it was, but imagined it to be a lullaby. On the other hand, he'd heard Highland women sing their babies asleep often enough, with things like Nian Nan Kiag, which dealt with severed heads and blood-soaked ground. But Mrs. Hardman was a friend. Presumably she'd have no truck with that sort of lullaby. Maybe the great Silky of Sul Skerry, he thought, beginning to relax. Clearly friends had no objection to carnal relations as such. That reminded him of bloody John Grey, and he grimaced, then stifled a grunt as his back sent a warning shot down his leg, indicating that even that much movement wouldn't be tolerated. The song was no more music to him than the snoring, but both were gentle sounds, and he eased himself cautiously, checked that knife and pistol were easily to hand, and shut his eyes. He was tired to the bone, but doubted he'd sleep. He couldn't even shift himself in the bed without white stabs of pain jabbing him in the backside like the devil's pitchfork. It had been years since his back had last done this to him. Ached frequently. Now and then was stiff in the morning. But it hadn't done this in 10 years. He remembered it vividly. It was soon after they'd come to the ridge, just after he and Ian built the cabin. He'd gone out hunting, sprung over a bank in pursuit of a fleeing elk, and found himself lying on his face at the foot of the bank, quite unable to move. Claire, bless her, had come searching for him, and he smiled wryly at the thought of it. She'd been so proud of tracking him through the forest.
If she hadn't found him, well, it would have been the luck of the draw as to whether a painter, bear, or wolf came upon him before his back released its clench and let him move. He supposed he wouldn't have died of cold, though he might well have lost a few toes to frostbite. A sound brought his head up fast. His back stabbed viciously, but he set his teeth, ignoring it, and pulled the pistol out from underneath his pillow. Mrs. Hardman's head jerked up at his movement. She stared at him, wide-eyed, then heard what he had heard and got up hastily. Feet on the path, more than one pair. She turned, looking for the cradle, but he shook his head. "Keep the bairnie with you," he said, low-voiced. "Answer when they knock. Open if they ask." He saw her swallow, but she did as he said. There were three or four, he thought, but not bent on mischief. There were feet on the porch, low murmurs, and a bit of laughing. A knock, and Mrs. Hardman called, "Who's there?"
"Friends, missus," said a man's voice, slurred with drink. "Let us in."
She cast a frightened glance at Jamie, but he nodded, and she lifted the latch, opening the door to the night. The first man started to come in, but then saw Jamie on the bed and stopped, mouth open.
"Good evening to you,"
Jamie said, polite, but holding the other man's eyes with his own. The pistol lay in plain sight under his hand.
"Oh,"
said the other man, disconcerted. He was young and rather stout, dressed in hunting garb but with a militia badge. He glanced over his shoulder at his companions, who had stopped on the threshold.
"Good evening to you, sir. We didn't, we thought..."
He cleared his throat. Jamie smiled at him, well aware what he thought. Keeping the man in sight from the corner of his eye, he turned to Mrs. Hardman and gestured to her to sit down. She did, and bent her head over the child, brushing her lips over Chastity's tiny cap.
"We've nothing to offer you in the way of food, gentlemen," Jamie said. "But there's cold water from the well, and a bed in the shed, if you need it."
The other two men stood outside, shuffling awkwardly. There was a strong smell of liquor coming off them, but they hadn't come in a mood to do damage.
"That's all right," the young man said, backing up to his friends.
His round face was flushed, as much with embarrassment as with liquor.
"We'll just... Sorry to disturb you, sir."
The other two bobbed their heads, and all three retreated, shuffling and bumping into one another in their haste to leave. The last one pulled the door to, but not all the way. Mrs. Hardman rose and pushed it to with a small bang, then leaned against it, her eyes closed, the child clasped against her bosom.
"Thank you," she whispered.
"It's all right," he said. "They'll not come back. Put the bairn down and bar the door, aye?"
She did, then turned and leaned against the door, her hands pressed flat against it. She looked at the floor between her feet, breathing audibly for a moment, then slowly straightened. Her plain jacket was fastened with pins. He didn't know if this was to avoid the vanity of buttons, as the Moravians did, or whether she was simply too poor to have any. Her fingers fiddled nervously with the top pin, and then she suddenly pulled it out and laid it glinting on the shelf. She looked directly at him then, her fingers gripping the head of the next pin. Her long upper lip was pressed down, and a nervous sweat glistened on it.
"Dinna even think about it," he said bluntly. "In my present condition I couldna swive a dead sheep. To say nothing of which, I'm old enough to be your father, lass, and I'm merit forby."
Her mouth quivered slightly, though he couldn't tell whether with disappointment or relief. Her fingers relaxed, though, and her hand dropped to her side.
"You dinna need to pay me for the food, lass," he said. "It was a gift."
Yes, I know. I thank thee, friend."
She looked aside, swallowing.